So tonight I wanted to start off with a little storytelling, since it's always kind of fun to do, and weave it into my Dharma talk here this evening. So I realized, you know, last year I wasn't here. I was on a 3.5 month sabbatical, but the first month of it, I took a group of 20 people, and we crossed the Himalayas, went through, it's called the Kingdom of Lo, or Amustang, sometimes called Little Tibet. And we walked for 250 miles and went over a 17,500-foot pass. And I sort of survived. You know, it was, that was, I think it's my, it was, Chris is my last, was the last hurrah that, you know, that was a lot. And then I had, it was a great trip, because then I, do you know who Ani Tenzin Palmo is? I'll read a little piece of her at the end. She's a great, when I was crossing the Himalayas, this is not this year, but last summer, by vehicle, I went by Lahul Spiti, where she lived in a cave for 12 years. You know, she's actually a wonderful teacher. No. And so on my way, I went to one of her teachings for some days for dependent origination. And she's quite remarkable, you know, very humble and straightforward. And then I made it on. I spent 2 weeks with Dalai Lama that year in Ladakh, Kalichak, before I went into self-retreat for a month. And then I got to spend some more time with Dalai Lama. And then I came back here. But this year, you know, I try to go every year, and part of it is just the capacity. You know, like everybody, I get comfortable, even in the teaching process. You know, somehow familiar and comfortable, and so there has to be some way that you kind of break down some of the. The protectionism and safety kind of piece. And I'm famous for that, so it's no big deal. You know? So I planned on the summer, I was going to climb Mount Fuji. And so I planned everything around spending a month in Japan, and then and I thought it opened the 1st of June. So I got all prepared and everything ready. And then I finally end up reading that they don't open it till the 1st of July. So I'd already planned all my trip and everything. So I go and I spend my time in Japan with, you know, anyway, in Kyoto. It's always something I had kind of dreamed of doing. And then I suddenly, and it's, you know, it's quite expensive in Japan, even though the yen is really great. So I went to Bali for 3 weeks, you know, not a bad thing, you know, it was much cheaper. and then I came back, and the way I had it, I got this ticket that actually it went to Bali, stopped in Japan for a month, and went to Bali, and then came back to Japan. And so I came back and for 6 days so I could climb Mount Fuji. That was part of my whatever craziness I have, you know. So I kind of did this research, and there's a town called Fujinomiya, and it is it's very interesting because traditionally the do you know what a torii gate is? The Japanese torii gates, you know. Well, there's these series of torii gates that go up to the top of Mount Fuji, you know. And so this was the old pilgrimage route, and there's a much easier route that you go, but this is the original route. And it's very steep. I forget, it's 27% or something like that grade. So, but here's the interesting part. So, at the bottom of the mountain, in Fujinomiya, is this temple. And this temple, you go to, and there is a big torii gate, which is the beginning of the pilgrimage to Mount Fuji. And I've been doing pilgrimages all my life, and it's the only way to go. You know. Because it's tested and true, extension of the spiritual journey, you know, or exemplify of it. So you go, and there's this huge temple in, you know, 15th century, the shogun, you know, built this huge thing. But what it was it's actually not in the sense Buddhist Zen, it's Shinto. And so they have a goddess, and the goddess has been captured and been put in the center of the temple. And so they have like these women priests that take care of it, but she's closed, you know, inside, captured there. And they say, oh, if she comes out, then there hasn't been a volcanic eruption on that mountain since 1707. So this is the thing, the Shinto, is that, you know, they're very earth-based people, earth-based magic, really. And so that keeps it from erupting. So, but it's also the beginning of the pilgrimage, you know. You go and kind of do your thing. And then there, in the village, is this the water that comes up from the volcano. I mean, torrents of water. And you go to bathe in that water, very cold. And that is the beginning of the pilgrimage. So there I am. First day, and I'm ready to go, you know. And it's raining. Second day, it's raining. Third day, it's raining. And what I don't know, because I really couldn't get all the info, was there was a typhoon south of Japan that was just torrential rains, you know. So I had 6 days. So on my sixth morning, it's do or die. So, and this, oh, the other thing is that I thought they said the second it would open, but it actually was the 10th, you know? So it was closed, actually, the mountain. So, you know, I get there, and early in the morning I take a taxi. It's like $100 to get there, and because nobody's around. And I get up to the first, kind of after the first little section there, climbing, and I got all my gear on, I'm ready, and I'm covered with all kinds of plastic and, you know, REI stuff, you know. And I get up there, and they say it's closed due to snow. And so I get up there, and I go, oh my God, what, you know, here I've come all this way, I've done all this stuff, and I'm looking at just clouds that are like everywhere, you know, but it's not raining right then. And so there are two kind of Japanese in there, REI equipment, and they go round the back and go up, and I go, yes! So, you know, I take off, and I go, boy, nobody's around. There's nobody around. And so it's 12,500 feet, and you start, Fuji no Maya is 600 feet altitude. So it's, you know, a bit of a climb. So I take off, and I get partway, and the thunder gods come, and it just starts, you know. And it said on the report, it said 65 kilometer an hour winds, you know, torrential rains and sleet. So, you know, that's fine for me, right? So I take off, and, you know, it's like, I did go through some questions, you know, like maybe this wasn't the brightest thing, and, you know, maybe next time, you know, but it just felt like, you know, it's kind of like life. There isn't a next time. So I said, I had to do this. And I climb. And oh, I have a little thing of oxygen to take with me and a bunch of, you know, I don't know, these little things, squirty things that have, you know, honey and protein and all this stuff in it, you know. So I'm okay. I got, oh, and there's nothing is open, you know, because it's pre-season. So, you know, the water you have with you is all you have. I had 3 liters of water, so it's okay. And so I climbed, and I'm not even halfway up, you know, the thunder gods come, and it starts to pour, you know. And one thing about volcanoes is that, you know, there's one thing, there's all the kind of broken little pieces, but it's slippery, you know. It's, you know, it's black, kind of shiny rock. But, you know, one thing, it's sort of like sitting, you know. There was determination to do it, you know? And we have kind of that in our culture of this. It's like you sit there and you sit there and you just keep sitting. Well, in this case, you keep climbing and you keep climbing and you keep climbing. And I do, I have very good willpower. I did find that out, you know? And many hours later, and again, I didn't really see where I was going, so it didn't really matter. I couldn't see how far it was away. You know, I'd get to these stations, you know, and I don't know, there are 8 stations or something like that. And so I could tell when I got to the stations, but, you know, usually they have food and water and all the stuff there, but they were slammed shut, you know. But at least it gave you some idea that, you know, you've gotten somewhere and you were going somewhere, you know. I kind of like that. So sometimes I wish the practice had more of that. But so I kept climbing, and eventually I made it to, and I met a young girl. She spoke English. She had been in Australia, and she was a mountain guide for Mount Fuji. And so at the Torii Gate, the top gate, I had her take my picture in the rain, right? Pouring rain, just covered. But you can see me there. And because I did that on the 7th of July, the Japanese government gave me a certificate of accomplishment, right? That's a pretty big deal. I don't know, I can't read it, but that's okay.
It might be a ticket.
Yeah, who knows? So I just, you know, it was great, because it just was that thing of willpower and determination. The one thing I never count on, which had happened to me the year before when we did this past 17.5, and it wasn't going uphill that was bad. It was the descent. And I had these titanium poles, you know, very lightweight, strong poles, you know. And the wind, the gusts of wind would come up, and I'd bounce off, literally, I fell down quite a few times, but I'd bounce off the poles, you know. And but I guess I got about halfway down. And I had a knee brace because I had something that happened to me in the summer before trekking in Nepal. But the only problem was that everything was so soaking wet that the thing kept sliding off and going down to my ankles, you know? And by this time, you know, I had all these great plastic clothes on, all that stuff, you know? But my boots were full of water, you know? And it was just slush, 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 you know? But it was actually, you know, it was great practice, you know? But I got really tired. And it's the first time, you know, I really kind of challenged myself in a lot of ways. Nobody was around. And it was heading towards dark. And I was just a little past halfway. And I fell. And I got scared, you know. And again, it was sort of like that thing, oh, here, I've done it again. Just like I took off in the 60s for Asia. All alone, just, you know, hell or high water. But I hit high water and hell. You know, and you know, at that point, I'm pretty good, but I got scared and realized that, you know, I didn't have the last half of that. I didn't have the strength. You know, 69 years old or 69 and a half, and my mind is better than my body sometimes. And so it was a really kind of a thing where I had that recognition, you know. And I'm here, so I made it down. And I actually, it took me 5 trains to get to this little town, right? And that when I came down that, I didn't get down till 7. I was completely soaking wet. And I found the wonders of hair dryers, you know, to dry off my stuff so I could get back to the States. Because the next morning I had a 5-hour bus ride to the airport, and then, of course, the 3 hours or 4 hours there, and then a 9-hour flight, you know. So it was a great teaching, you know, I'm not going to, they say in Japan, you climb Fuji once, only a fool climbs it twice. So anyway, that's, you know, it's always fun stories, you know. But there's always something, you know, when you stretch a little, and it's really like retreats. You know, sometimes when I do month-longs, or I used to do this thing, it's called Puk practice, Tibetan. It's cave practice, where you go and you live in a cave, you know. And I've done it since, you know, since I was about 24. I've gone out, you know, usually you can only go for 7 days, but I could do it in this near this monastery in Ladakh, because I could go down for a shower and food. So it's a good deal. Better than years when I had nothing for miles and miles around. You know, I've done so many foolish-hardy things. So here's what I'm going to read to you, and then I'll continue with the Dharma expose here. No, it's not really. It's called Fuji-san. Waiting in the town of Fuji no Maya. 6 days waiting for a break in the weather. Little window, last day before returning to Turtle Island. The morning, glimmer of hope, no rain. Then the arduous pilgrimage to scale the volcano. How is it that we lock our own minds into journeys that mimic our desire for freedom? How is it that we lock our minds into journeys that mimic our desire for freedom? Could it be some old story of struggle and archetypal needs to let go of the seeker? Letting go of one more piece of the rigid framework of who we think we are. Not halfway up, the thunder gods brought the winds, rain, and sleet, suddenly locking everything down. Remembering the multiple journeys of one breath, one step, one breath, one step, over and over. I know somewhere deep down that I'm taking all my Dharma friends to the last Torii gate. I'm just a fragment of all these relationships, giving me strength to take one more step. Of course, at the top, there were no horns, choirs, or angels. Just nature saying, I'm much stronger than you. Nature's breath forces you to struggle to stay on your feet. You must bow deeply to this little life of yours, knowing you're utterly alone out here. That one slip on the volcanic rock can be disaster. But today, soaked to the bone, the angels have blessed your onward journey. May a little deeper understanding of the emptiness of it all, a bit more grace, bringing the heart into a little better alignment, caring for this one precious life. So. I've spent my life, 50 years, with a lot of the great masters of our times. And I've kind of settled in the last 20 years on the Thai forest tradition in its simplicity, you know. And Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Chah, none of these ever wrote anything, right? They were quoted a lot. But they themselves very much, and really, they were Northern Thai forest dwellers. They were called Dutangas. And Dutangas are, these are aesthetic monks that the Buddha allowed 13 different austerities. And one of my teachers, Burmese, when I first met him, he had not laid down for 40 years.
How's that?
You know, of course, he looked a little bit like Ray Charles, and he sat in kind of like a slumped chair. So you didn't know if he was awake or alive, actually. You know. But, you know, there was something about just going into the room with him. And I remember when I first met him, he said, you know, from across the room, there were like probably this many people in the room. And I was way in the back, and he said, you have to take robes. And I thought he was kidding, you know. But I got it. He was not kidding. And it was important, you know. But, you know, whoever he was, he was also considered nice, the Burmese at that time. He was, like the Japanese have in their artisans, that he was considered a national treasure. You know, I wonder if we had, you know, beings of that sort that were national treasures. You know, it'd be cool. Even the great artisans, you know. So I'd like to just read some pieces from this, you know, this lineage that goes back into the... one thing about the fourth tradition is Thailand now, northern Thailand, it once was just a canopy, you know. And one of the things, it was just teak forests. And so, you know, it was, there were levels of jungle, of how it was. And today, pretty much that's gone. But these monks lived out in the wild, you know. And there's all the things about, you know, living with tigers and, you know, soothing. The Thais have, they're just incredible stories, you know. But I'm not sure, because one of the things is we all need heroes, and this is our nature, you know, we want saviors. And so a lot of it, I think they have just created mythologies around, but they were great beings, you know, who, you know, when they kind of surrendered to the Dharma and to a life very much aestheticism, you know, they renunciation was paramount, you know. So I'd like to start, Ajahn Sao, we don't know, you know, there's not much written about him, but he was the teacher of Ajahn Mun, and Ajahn Mun was the teacher of Ajahn Chah. And then Ajahn Chah was teacher, kind of, at least it went through the Western community quite strongly. So I'd like to just read to you. I'm just going to, some of this is just little pieces, though. But it kind of gives you a level of, to me, the simplicity and the importance, you know. So this is from Ajahn Mun. And... he was 1870, died in 1949. He wrote one, there's a 15-page poem he wrote, which is the only thing we have, on the five skandhas, on the five aggregates, that, you know, they are not self, you know. So, but this is a quote that we have it at Spirit Rock, if you're in there, and there's a quote from him that is, I think, really paramount, you know. In your investigation of the world, never allow the mind to desert the body. In your investigation of the world, never allow the mind to desert the body. Examine its nature. See the elements that comprise it. See the impermanence, the suffering, and the selflessness of the body while sitting, standing, walking, or lying down. When its true nature is seen fully and lucidly by the heart, the wonders of the world will become clear. In this way, the purity of the mind can shine forth, timeless and delivered. In this way, the purity of the mind can shine forth, timeless and delivered. You know, it says a huge amount right there. And, you know, it's, I think this is so important for the Western culture because one of the things is we have trained ourselves out of the body into our heads. And yet this is just saying, okay, we have to, you know, reverse this and begin to train to inhabit, because one thing beautiful about the body is you can never put the same mind in the same body. Not possible. No. You cannot also to put the mind in the body. You know, it is. Because it is always in flow and in flux. It always is informing you about impermanence, where the mind can make up concepts and ideas and plans and opinions and views and judgments, which are static, you know, that we can hold to them. But you can't if you actually attend to the body. And this is why that particular experience and practice is so fundamental to how this works. This is one of, I'll just read this from Ajahn Chah. Only one book is worth reading, The Heart. That's Ajahn Chah. So, I have two pieces. They're kind of a little different here. But this is Ajahn Chah speaking about what he considers normal state. And this is a description of it. You will see when the heart and mind is unattached, it is abiding in its normal state. Okay? You will see when the heart mind is unattached, it is abiding in its normal state. When it stirs from normal because of various thoughts and feelings, the process of thought construction takes place, in which solutions are created. Learn to see through this process. When the mind has stirred from the normal, it leads away from right practice to one of the extremes of indulgence or aversion, thereby creating more illusion, more thought construction. Good or bad only arise in your mind. If you keep watch on your mind, study the one your whole life, I guarantee you will never be bored. Not bad, huh? No. So normal, you know, to him, a normal is actually three fundamentals, you know. That one thing, you're aware of impermanence, that all things arise and pass, you're aware of that, you know, that's normal. And that any kind of grasping has the nature of suffering. And it's an impersonal process, you know. We attach personal to it, but in essence, it's just the impersonal process happening. These are the fundamental things. And that's what normal, from an awakened mind, it is. One of the beauties here is Ajahn Chah only spent 3 days of his life. Ajahn Mun, he was like moving around so much that people could not find him. People would search this man out, you know. But he was just impossible to find. He was just a roadie, you know. And he was moving all the time. And many people who met him, he had the ability to change their minds. You know. So Ajahn Chah says those 3 days that he had been a monk for 20 years, and he had practiced and practiced, and he knew something about the absolute, you know, and the relative. And so he says, oh, I lived in the relative, and I had experience of the absolute, but when I met Ajahn Mun, my mind turned. And then I was looking from the absolute at the relative. Mm-hmm. Follow? It's a lot to say. That means that was the awakening that happened, right? And it was only 3 days. Ajahn Mun was gone, you know. And but that then changed Ajahn Chah, you know. And he really became one of Thailand's great teachers. Simple man. Now, one of the unusual things why I have personally kind of touched into this lineage as something that makes so much sense to me has to do with one of the disciples of Ajahn Mun, not Ajahn Chah, but Ajahn Mahabua. And he was actually he's very well revered in Thailand. As a saint. But I want to read this to you because to me this was one of the most important moving things that allowed me to see that it wasn't just so fixed, that there was more to this. Whatever arises has to vanish. Whatever is true, whatever is of a natural principle in of itself won't vanish. In other words, the pure mind won't vanish. Everything of every sort may vanish, but that which knows their vanishing doesn't vanish. Do you follow what's happening when I say that? This vanishing, that vanishing, but the one which knows their vanishing doesn't vanish. Whether or not we try to leave it untouched, it keeps on knowing. The mind blankets everything. So what's big for me in this is that that in the aggregates there is form or body, there is feeling, there is perception, there is mental formation, and consciousness. And that in the five aggregates, the Buddha is very explicit saying consciousness is impermanent. In this particular vantage point. So it simply, with the objects, arises and passes away at, you know, incredible speeds, you know. And sometimes I like to look at it as like, you know, you look at a candle from a distance and you think it's a solid flame, right? And if you equate the fire to consciousness, but if you get really close to that candle and you look at it, you'll see that due to the wax, that it is constantly reigniting itself at tremendous speed, appearing to be solid. And that's where we think the self in that way is solid. You know. But from this vantage point, which the Buddha was pointing at, all the aggregates or the streams or the skandhas, they are simply part of an impermanent process that arises for some time and then it dies, just like everybody in this room. You know, that is the nature of the aggregates. But what Mahabhu is pointing at is there's something, the knowing itself is something that doesn't vanish. No. And so in a sense, it's like saying there is, and sometimes in some of the tradition, Tibetan tradition, they talk about the Buddha nature. You know, it is a quality that we have, that we're born with, that has the propensity to fully awaken. You know, if it wasn't there, we wouldn't be here. You know, and it's the same way. Why in the hell would anybody stupidly climb some mountain in the rain? You know, knowing that. Somehow, is it something about that Sometimes we need to have some internal mountain that we climb, you know. So the knowing itself doesn't vanish. Everything else vanishes. No. And this is unique to the Thai forest tradition. No. It's also found in the Advaita of the in Shankar of the 8th century, who really was the non-dual Ramana Maharshi and that whole lineage. There's also in the Tibetan, there's this Mahamudra teachings and Dzogchen teachings. Maybe none of this makes sense to you, but they all were referring to this truth that the knower itself is something that's not impermanent, something that actually rests in truth and reality, you know. And it is uniqueness to our humanness. And in many ways, this particular truth has to be pointed out to you. It's not something that a lot of times inherently we get, you know. But it has been passed down from generations to generations, you know, that somehow that the knowing itself is unique and free in its nature. No, it's saying that that truth is not dependent on the five aggregates, not dependent on feeling, form, perception, mental formations, or consciousness. You know, I mean, that's cool. You know, and I know this. You may not get this, but it's okay. You don't need to. You just have to know that I'm pointing at something. You know. So. Now, one of the beauties of the of this tradition, a forest tradition, is its simplicity and its ability to describe practice in probably in the most simple way. And I remember hearing this of Jack Kornfield. You know, it's happened to many, many people have used this, and you've probably heard these pieces, but. And it's simply noted as the one seat, you know. And so the one seat is you actually take a chair and put it in the center of the room. And by sitting in the center of the room, the tradition is that there are five windows and a door. And the five windows are your five senses, right? And then there is the door, which is the mind, which kind of hinges both ways. The nature of our experience is that at any one moment there is an experience at one of the windows that many times comes from the outside or sometimes from the inside, and it entrances us to somehow say, oh, I'm going to follow that, you know, where to? You know, out there. The thing is, there's no place to go out there. You understand that? There's no place to go. You know, that wherever you go out there, with I don't care if it's a smell or a sound or a thought, you will have to come back to the seat. You'll have to come back here. You know, those are little journeys, they go off, but if no matter how far you get out there, you come back. You know, in one of the texts, I use this description of a little bird on a boat, which you probably heard, some of you heard, you know, but it's so simple and primal. And that little bird is wanting to find land and land somewhere, The problem is, it's so far out in the ocean, and it's such a small little bird, that there's no place to land, just like all the senses and thoughts. And so they all fly out, and they all have to turn around and come back again to the boat. And the boat is us sitting in the center of that seat. You know, you got the description here. Okay. Now, please, I have several pieces of this from Ajahn Chah. And just a way to kind of talk around it. Just go into the room, put one chair in the center. Take a seat in the center of the room, open the doors and windows, and see who comes to visit. You will witness all kinds of scenes and actors, all kinds of temptations and stories, everything imaginable. Your only job is to stay in your seat. You will see it all arise and pass, and out of this wisdom and understanding will come. Okay? So that's one piece of it. Simple? Easy? You know? I mean, you're this, in that way, kind of the center of things, but this is a good description in a sense from the Abhidharma in our how we experience things. Here's another one. Oh, I think I'm going to read this. I'm going to read a long version of this because I want to, you know. but usually I just read the latter part of this. Do not take anything as yourself. A deception that causes you to like, grasp, or fear. When you see such constructions, do not get involved. All unusual experiences and visions are of value to the wise person, but harmful to the unwise. Keep practicing until you are not stirred by them. So, no, I mean, sometimes it's true that when we really sit, sometimes we go into beautiful trance states, there's lights, sometimes Buddhas appear, all kinds of things can appear, but not to be deceived by them. They are simply appearances, you know. And there's a wise way to hold them and also to be enchanted or entranced by them, you know. As I see it, the mind is like a single point, the center of the universe. And mental states are like visitors who come to stay at this point for short or long periods of time. Get to know these visitors well. That's what's important. Become familiar with the vivid pictures they paint, the alluring stories they tell to entice you to follow them. But do not give up your seat. It is the only chair around. If you continue to occupy it unceasingly, greeting each guest as it comes, firmly establishing yourself in awareness, transforming your mind into the one who knows, the one who is awake, the visitors will eventually stop coming back. If you give them real attention, how many times can these visitors return? Speak with them here. You will know every one of them well. Then your mind will at last be at peace. That's what you're doing.
Who's that by?
That's Ajahn Chah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I'll read one more piece by Ajahn Chah. Because it's all about his description of the one chair. He does such a good job. He's better than I can do. The visitors to your chair consists of images, plans, memories, dreams, thoughts, emotions, and many others. Once you acknowledge their presence, they will be happy to leave. Have you noticed that with thoughts? Particularly thoughts are kind of cool that way. You know, you go, oh, hi. Oh, gone. True? Not true. True, right? Simple acknowledgement. They will be happy to leave. However, you have to be sure to notice them and not let them take over the conversation going on in your mind. How will you sit silently with these visitors? Do you watch them come and go, or do you try to entertain them? Busted. No. So this is you know, this is the art here of somehow, and I love the description of you know, if you kind of center yourself and know that you're kind of sitting in the center of yourself, you know. And you have these sense doors, the seeing, the smelling, the tasting, the hearing, the body sensations, and the thoughts. They're all these windows and doors. And the idea, a lot of times, a lot of these practices, it's traditional, we kind of think of it as we shut the doors and windows. But that's not what these practices are saying. The practice is saying, like, I'm open to things coming and going. No. But going is important because they come unbidden. You know, it's like you're sitting there and you're just sitting in your chair and you're watching your breath, and suddenly these jugglers and clowns, and they come in with little signs, and they you know, they're just trying the hardest to get your attention. And if you buy it, then you jump out the window and you follow them out. But it's like the little bird. There's nowhere to go. There's no place to land. There's never been any place to land. No. And so, bingo, as soon as that remembers, almost immediately, you're back in your seat. No.
So I guess you're in trouble if you come back to your seat and somebody else is sitting there?
If you continuously occupy the seat, none of them have a chance to take the seat over. And that is the principle of practice, is you stay in your seat. And that's where, going back to Ajahn Mun, stay in your body. Nobody can do that. No. And so you do not leave your seat. And if you do leave your seat, yes, you could give it up for, you know, for something. But because instantaneously, as soon as awareness knows itself, it's back. You know, so whatever's there can't stay. You know. But then we start getting more and more comfortable with just staying. You know. And you'll still get captured, you know, entranced. I like the word bamboozled, you know. And and it, you know, this is, you've got a 10-day retreat here. And a lot of you both done this stuff, you know, you'll get it, you know, but you have to be convinced that the images, the stories, here they have no value in your life. I'm not saying they're not. But here, what has value is, are in a sense, I like this terminology, is that when something comes to one of the windows or door, we bow to it, acknowledge it, know it. In a way, it does the same back to us, if it's completely acknowledged. No. Otherwise, it kind of can squeeze you out of the chair. Or you run off following it. So the last piece is really about the knower. You know, that if all that's seen here is an impermanent process that in some ways seems so solid and real. But from the watcher's point of view, and knowing, in watching this for some time of staying in that seat, then it begins to question the reality of all of it. You know? And it begins to see the illusion of it all, in the sense that, you know, the mind, it has a tendency to concretize and hold and believe what it sees, tastes, smells, saw as solid. And but sitting there in that seat and seeing it all come and go enough times, one begins to say, oh, you know, it's not as a real world as I believed it to be. It's actually possibly just, you know, empty of any inherent existence of its own. Okay, now you got to get this. Empty of any inherent existence on its own. Now, that's a huge statement, because what it's saying is that there's nothing that, even though it's empty of any concretized single nature, it is also nothing is separate. No. And it's really this thing of emptiness and form. It's saying that it's exactly the way it is. This is exactly the way it is. There's nothing you can change in this moment. I can't pick up one thought and run out the door and take it with me. Okay? Can't do that. You know? So things are exactly as they are. But it's also, I become deluded, delusional about the solidity and the reality of it. Okay? Now, this is a big talk. But you don't have to get this right away, but little by little, you start to break down the the entrancement with the world as it is, you know, and you start saying, oh, you know, maybe I just let go just a little bit more, because it's not as solid, and I'm not as solid, and none of it's as solid as I've been told and made it up to believe. Okay. And this is from Tenzin Palmo, who I said I went to a retreat of hers last year, and I visit her in India several times. She comes to the States once in a while, usually. She has the most incredible nunnery. I'll tell you a little story about it, because I'm so moved by her simpleness and her support of the Vipassana community as well. You know, is that they're Thokdens. And Thokdens were these Tibetan yogis who lived in caves, and they had sometimes their matted hair was 6 feet long. I remember once in the early 70s, I went to right near there, Tashijong, and they were having all these Lama dances and stuff. And these yogis, some of the Thokdens, came out, and they jumped up in the air, maybe 4 feet, and they put themselves into full lotus and then came down on their spines. You know? And that was miraculous. They didn't harm them at all. It showed, you know, that whatever, you know, they also, maybe there was kind of levitation. But it, for a spectator, it was like, whoa, you know? And then you kind of, whoa. You know, that's no trick, you know? That's, you know, maybe it's lightness of body or whatever. But they looked totally outrageous, you know? They're just like, you know, they're cave creatures, you know? So, anyway. This is from On Reflections on a Mountain Lake, Teachings on Practical Buddhism. As we begin to develop awareness of the mind itself appears to divide in two. A new aspect of the mind arises. This is referred to as variously as the witness, the seer, the knower, the observer. It witnesses without judgment and without comment. That's what I was trying to point at, as in that seat, that it's possible that when we're not caught in thinking, we're not, it's just in what Ajahn calls normal, at least for him. Along with the arrival of the witness, a space appears within the mind. This enables us to see thoughts and emotions as mere thoughts and emotions, rather than as me and mine. When the thoughts and emotions are no longer seen as me and mine, we begin to have choices. This is the secret. When thoughts and emotions are no longer seen as me and mine, we begin to have choices. Certain thoughts and emotions are helpful, so encourage them. Others are not so helpful, so we just let them go. All thoughts and emotions are recognized and accepted. Nothing is suppressed. But now we have a choice about how to react. We can give energy to the ones which are useful and skillful and withdraw energy from those which are not. Pretty simple, huh? I mean, this is not anything too complicated, but it's incredibly important, you know, that we kind of be able to sit in that seat and watch it all come and go, and learn about freedom. That when we're in normal, we can experience freedom. And when we're not, we're running out the window at the door. So, that's all, folks. Let's just sit for a moment.